Last but not least, and I just want to say a quick thing about Jennifer. She's fantastic, and we're really lucky to have her in the field. Her official title, though, is Director of Legal Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. And if you're not familiar with that group, you certainly should be. They are emerging as the national leader on both research, policy, and advocacy on all things related to food policy. And Jennifer has been a tremendous addition to their team as their crackerjack lawyer. So Jennifer's going to talk to us about the First Amendment.
Thank you. Just a note, we don't advocate, but we educate, because we're part of a university. but thank you so much. That was very sweet. So today I will be talking about some emerging issues that are going on in childhood obesity and how the First Amendment relates. My presentation actually is not based on the paper that Q mentioned earlier, but on the work I've been doing this year, and actually a paper I am doing for NPLAN right around now. So there's a few papers I have coming out on this topic. I have no relationships to disclose. And today I will be just focusing on point of purchase marketing. And by point of purchase, I'm also referring to the product's packaging. So not only what happens in the retail environment, but also on the packaging. Some of the statistics include some quick service restaurant statistics, but I will be focusing on the retail environment for the most part. So the companies now are using all types of techniques to market to children at the point of purchase and on packaging, including the ones I've listed above. And the 2008 study by the FTC actually found that $195 million are spent at point of purchase marketing to children. And this is 12% of all the youth targeted marketing. And if you'll remember the point of purchase marketing themselves, the most marketed items from the FTC study were quick service restaurants, snacks, cereals, beverage, candy, and dessert. And the most astounding part of this is it's actually only second to TV advertising. So everyone's, you know, always focusing on television advertising and the effects it has. But here we have the second most highly spent area by the industry. And in fact, a report just came out yesterday that the food manufacturers and retailers are actually increasing their point of purchase marketing as the regulators, advocates start to hound on them for TV advertising. The point of purchase advertising is actually going to be increasing. So I bet at the next FTC study we see an increase in the dollars. So a study out of Yale showed that 79% of all food promotions are directed at children under 12. And this breaks down in an interesting way. Preschoolers get 22% of the point of purchase promotions, children 57%, and the general audience only 21%. And most of the promoted foods are unhealthy by all objective standards. So moving on to packaging, there's this great study out of Canada of fun packaging of regular foods. So the study actually excluded confectionery and junk food and looked at actual meals that are marketed to children using the same techniques that I mentioned earlier, and found that 89% of all the fun food packaging was unhealthy, and 63% of them actually had one or more nutrition claim. And to put it another way, 62% of the unhealthy foods had one or more nutrition claims. And the most used technique was using a cartoon. So 3/4 of these packaged food had cartoons on the packaging. So with all this evidence, it's really not surprising that the IOM's review of over 100 studies found that children 2 to 3 recognize food packaging. And even worse, a study out of Yale confirmed earlier studies that children actually prefer snacks and prefer the taste of snacks of the identical food when there is a cartoon character on the snack. So this is a real issue. So where is industry when it comes to that? The Better Business Bureau has the Child Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative, and there are 17 companies that have pledged to market only better-for-you items to children under 12. There are 15 food and beverage manufacturers, so I'm excluding the two quick-service restaurants. There's not one pledge covering in-store promotions. There are two pledges covering the product's packaging, and I have put those companies' packaging on the bottom of the screen to let you know how strong those pledges are. Each pledge is based on the company's own nutritional criteria, which matches no independent scientific criteria for nutrition. And retailers have not been involved in this process, yet they're obviously a major component of what's going on. So going back to labels, the FDA has authority over labels. The FDA has announced that it's having a front-of-package label initiative, and this is in response to the proliferation of each company's own symbol, system, label, marking that their product is healthy. So you've seen check marks and nutrition spots and all these kind of things. So the FDA said, we're going to create a voluntary front-of-package symbol for companies to use so we will have a uniform system. In the midst of this, the IOM has completed its initial report and announced it and gave it to the FDA last month. They gave an initial recommendation to how the FDA should proceed with their front of package symbol, and they're going to give their final recommendation in the summer of 2011. 2 weeks after this announcement, the Grocery Manufacturers Association announced that the leading food and beverage manufacturers and retailers are going to come up with their own symbol. What's shocking about this is they've already done this. It was called Smart Choices, and I'm sure you've all heard that the Connecticut Attorney General and the FDA were concerned that Smart Choices was misleading, deceptive. The Smart Choices program shut down 2 weeks after these concerns were announced. So I don't know what they're going to be doing differently, but clearly this is an effort to avoid regulation. Even though the FDA's front of package initiative is going to be voluntary, it doesn't have to be, and I'll get to that in a moment. So the FDA announced that it will continue to enforce the law on false and misleading labels. There will be no action on packaging promotions, which we know is a really big problem, and no action on health and nutrition claims. Now, I bring up health and nutrition claims because in February of this year, two leading researchers published an article in JAMA calling for either a revision or a ban of health or nutrition claims. They had a great article and very convincing statements about it, but there we have the First Amendment, which I'll be getting to in a moment. But the FDA allows all these types of nutrition claims. Some of them are based on absolutely almost no evidence, such as qualified health claims, and some of them do not even need pre-approval by the FDA, such as structure function claims. If I had another 5 minutes, I'd explain these all to you, and I'm happy to at another time. But health and nutrition claims are very problematic, and every study has confirms their problem. There are a lot of studies on each of these issues. The White House, the First Lady's report actually said that over 50% of Americans distrust these claims. They often misleadingly convey healthiness for products that aren't. In fact, the cereal study out of Yale showed that the most unhealthy cereals marketed to children had 3 to 4 claims per box. And qualified health claims have already been found to be misleading in studies. There is a study commissioned by the FDA recently of over 7,000 people, and nobody was able to effectively evaluate a qualified health claim. Studies have shown that they detract from the use of Nutrition Facts Panel, they increase the purchase of those products, and of course, this is especially problematic when you have a product with packaging directed at children, so the children are nagging their parents for the product. The parent sees 3 to 4 health and nutrition claims on the product and probably thinks, you know what, this is not that bad of a product for my child. And so it doubles the problem of having health and nutrition claims. So now where is the First Amendment in all this? The First Amendment protects the right of speech. Originally, it was conceived of as protecting a more religious political speech, and the Supreme Court has interpreted it to also protect commercial speech. And commercial speech is been defined as a speech that proposes a transaction. So marketing and advertising is commercial speech. Also, commercial speech are labels and claims. So these are covered under the protections by the First Amendment. Now, there's other aspects going on our packaging. One is compelled speech. The Nutrition Facts Panel is actually compelled speech, which means it's factual disclosure requirements required by the government. Basically, you cannot sell a product without disclosing factual information about what you're selling, and that's what the Nutrition Facts Panel is. There's also government speech, Surgeon General warnings on tobacco products, that's government speech. And then there's a third type of protected activity that's not actually speech, but it has an expressive component, and this is called expressive conduct. And this is conduct that has expressive component, but doesn't need speech to make its point. So burning a flag to protest the war is considered expressive conduct. Now, pure conduct is not protected by the First Amendment. Pure conduct does not have an expressive component. And the best legal arguments suggest that sale of products are not protected by the First Amendment, that they're just regular conduct. And I will get to that a little more. Now, so packaging, we know, is commercial speech. The uniform front of package symbol, although the FDA is saying it's going to be voluntary, they actually could require a uniform front of package symbol that's simply disclosing factual information about the product. And I think this is why the GMA made its recent announcement, because they really do want to avoid any kind of regulation. Now, we also know misleading claims can be restricted. So the JAMA article called for some restrictions of claims. There are really good arguments to restrict a lot of the claims, but qualified health claims have been proven to be misleading in practice. There's a long history, legal history and case law history on qualified health claims that I'd be happy to share, but now we know that they are misleading based on studies. So this is different than when they were initially introduced into the marketplace. But what about characters? Characters on products intended for adults have been protected as commercial speech. So remember that for adult products, characters have been protected as commercial speech. But what about for children's products? Most of the work is done on licensed products, and there's a great argument to say that it's really deceptive. We know that children actually prefer the taste of the exact identical food with the product, with the character on it. Every single movie and television show that has the same licensed character is actually an advertisement for that food product. And also, children can't understand that the product is marketing to them, especially children under 8. So we have a great argument that products are deceptive, and you can restrict or ban deceptive speech. But there's also another route to go, and that is to make nutritional requirements for the use of these kind of techniques. So maybe you have to meet a nutritional threshold in order to put a character on your product. And that kind of a restriction would be able to apply to all promotional techniques, not just characters. Finally, we have also government speech. Now, the 5-a-day Fruita campaign is government speech, and that's positive government speech, but there are also warning government speeches. This one on the bottom left is actually currently in litigation, but if you ever come to New York City, you could see that where they sell tobacco, these kind of warnings are at the point of purchase in tobacco places that sell tobacco. But you can imagine graphic health warnings for food. I should note that it's in litigation for First Amendment and also preemption. The First Amendment argument is likely going to fail, but the preemption argument's going to win. So back to Mark's point of preemption being a problem. But that's because the tobacco industry has different regulations. Right, nothing's preempting a local government from having a health warning for food near the point of purchase. So within retail establishments, we also have the concept of regulating conduct. So I said earlier that sales are probably considered regular speech. I say probably only because when Massachusetts banned the self-service displays of tobacco products, the court upheld it, the Supreme Court upheld it, but said it's assumed that there's an expressive component to displaying tobacco products in the manner the retailer wants. This language is discomforting, but it doesn't matter because the Supreme Court still upheld the ban on self-service displays of tobacco, and they did say it's a valid regulation of conduct. So local governments can regulate conduct or sales as long if it's furthering a public health interest. The Supreme Court has said in the past, when you're regulating conduct or sales, you're allowed to experiment with solutions. This is a very key statement because in commercial speech areas, you're not allowed to really experiment with solutions to the same extent. You need evidence to support those kind of things. Where here, you can experiment with solutions as long as you're not targeting expression. So the Supreme Court has actually come up with some of its own ideas on how to regulate products within retail establishments that have nothing to do with targeting expressions. Increase prices, limit per capita purchases, ban or limit harmful ingredients or the products themselves, institute age limits to purchase, possess, or use the products, and restrict access. So these are all Supreme Court ideas to deal with harmful products. And we've seen this in practice. Taxes on cigarettes have decreased the likelihood of purchase of cigarettes. There are some states that have limits on the amount of ephedrine-containing products one person can purchase at a time. New York City banned trans fat, which is banning a harmful ingredient. And then there are age limits to buy alcohol, tobacco, and to go into gaming institutions. And then for restriction of access, we see two different types. We have tobacco and ephedrine-containing products are often required to be behind counters, but also San Francisco banned the sale of tobacco in pharmacies, and the Ninth Circuit said the sale of tobacco is not speech, and it was the most clear explanation saying sale is not speech. So that's a really good statement and to support these arguments. And if you think that sugar-sweetened beverages are also a problem, we can apply the exact same ideas that the Supreme Court applied to sugar-sweetened beverages. We can tax them. We can limit per capita purchases or the serving size of sugar-sweetened beverages. We can limit the harmful ingredients. I've heard a lot of people at the conference talking about extreme energy drinks. Well, you could limit the amount of sugar or caffeine allowed in these energy drinks. Now, age limits to purchase. The tobacco groups have found that restrictions on possession and use by minors are not an effective method of dealing with it, despite the Supreme Court suggestion. But the age limits on purchase are an effective method of dealing with keeping children away from harmful products and restricting access, for example, in or near schools. So finally, I have come up with some other ideas that can be implemented in the place of purchase. I've written a whole paper on only three of them, and these ideas follow from the Supreme Court's ideas. So the first are ban junk food in checkout aisles. And there's so much research to support this by the marketing groups. The retailers find that if they use self-checkout, actually, that could save a consumer 7,200 calories a year. So we even have the retailers' research to support our regulations. Specially marked aisles. So we could see the sugar-sweetened beverage being next to the cookies now instead of the healthy cereal. So parents can avoid aisles with just junk food and be able to navigate through the supermarket without having to deal with their children pestering them. Restrict end-of-aisle displays to healthy foods. The retail and marketing groups call the end-of-aisle displays ground zero for getting past a harried shopper's basket. So that's why when you see at the end of the aisle, they're always the most unhealthy junk food that you could grab and throw into your basket. Marketing research also shows that the default shelves, which are the shelves that are the natural resting eye position of the average male or female, which is the central shelves, are the default shelves. There's a great study out of the University of Chicago Business School that manipulated products up and down the shelves, and they found that that one facing at the central shelf was more effective than several facings anywhere else. So if we make it that only nutritious products could be in these shelves, that would make the healthy shelf the default shelf. Ban food samples to minors. I hear parents complaining all the time about people constantly giving their children food when they go into any kind of retail establishment. There is so much support to ban food samples to minors, not only nutrition, but health and safety and allergies, I mean, which are seriously increasing in our society. We can apply these same principles to vending machines, have healthy vending machine shelves. Serving size restrictions, we could do this in fast food restaurants, not only in the retail establishments like the sugar-sweetened beverage idea. And then nutrition requirements for toys. Now, we've seen Santa Clara and San Francisco's nutrition requirements to give out toys in fast food restaurants. But we can also do this for premiums. You could have a nutrition requirement to have a toy in a box. And one word about the San Francisco toy ordinance, they will likely get sued, but there's so much more evidence showing that this is just a regulation of conduct and sales than any kind of restriction on First Amendment speech. But that will be the issue that's going to be litigated if it gets sold. So anyway, I'm happy to answer any other questions, and I thank you for your attention. And if you do have questions and we don't get to talk, please email me. I'm always happy to talk to anybody, and I could send you my papers when they get published. Thank you.
And I tell you, she was great. So, terrific. So we have a good 15 minutes. Thank you, panelists, for staying on time. Always appreciate that. And I'm going to kick it off with a question on going back to preemption. And I actually opened this up for any of the panelists, because I know this is an issue that all of you are engaged with. And I'm wondering, first, Mark, is your project also designed to help advocates avoid the perils of preemption? What can we do to fight this problem?
Well, I mean, I think the first step in that is you know, we have really the knowledge we need at this point, if not before the research we've done, certainly now that we've done the research in preemption and movement building and public health. The critical element, I think, in being effective is to make sure that the leadership in public health, whether they're in the state or federal government or in major foundations that fund health or health policy, have the state-of-the-art knowledge about the impact of preemption on grassroots movements and on public health in general. But it's a good question, and I think more needs to be done. Our project is only at the halfway point, so we're now at the point of, I think, being more aggressive about educating. You know, there's a lot of good people. For example, everyone on this panel knows about preemption, and many are experts on preemption who know it and get it about how dangerous preemption is, including folks at the major foundations. But there are key people who are in positions of power and control resources who need to bring themselves up to the same level of expertise.
There's a question in the back, yeah. Lissy, yeah.
Jennifer,
can you explain that question, because I don't know what you mean?
Jennifer's what we call a real lawyer.
The preemption's in the
labeling. Oh, are you talking about tobacco preemption?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's you. The JAMA article is Nessel and Ludwig, February 2010.
Well, I mean, obviously the FDA authority over tobacco marketing and products is very important and very complex. I think that to the extent that the advocacy community can focus on the clear areas where preemption has been, if you will, repealed or clarified, I think that can be advantageous. Part of the problem, and one of the problems with preemption, one of the things I didn't say, which is that unfortunately pretty fundamental, is that in order not to have preemption, either implied or express preemption, it's vital that any federal or state health law have a savings clause, which means an anti-preemption clause that's very clear. So one of the problems with the FDA is simply that whenever there's confusion, it's an invitation to litigation. And there's nothing wrong with litigation when it's necessary, but I think one of the myriad concerns about FDA jurisdiction regarding tobacco products is that you give some of the best lawyers in the country who work for Altria and the other companies the opportunity to confuse and litigate. I don't want to get into that any further now, just because we have so many. There's more questions, I think, but I hope that answers the question a little bit.
There's definitely a lot of boilerplate language out there, and like Mark says, I mean, it's something that's done in alcohol policy. Whenever there's a state law proposed, we make sure that there's the boilerplate language that allows locals to go further if they want to. So that is really important. Okay, last question here.
Right, and the Heart Association, which has a very strong and simple policy that says federal and state preemption is never acceptable in tobacco. Well, the Heart Association is still figuring out, you know, getting its legs around preemption in nutrition and physical activity. So the question,
about the California? What's being done to make sure that as we move forward, these organizations who are present at the 11th hour will say no to preemption?
So that's a great question. I forgot to get this out. This is a checklist for anybody in public health who's even vaguely considering preemption that we just produced last week for Robert Johnson. And this is a fact sheet with much more information. So that kind of answers it, but the short of it, very short of it, is that everybody who's in public health, I would say especially people at the grassroots level, need to be engaged in deciding about preemption. It is never, if public health is going to thrive outside of tobacco, this is on our website. It's preemptionwatch, one word, .org. All of these materials are, and much more. But I would say that this is a fundamental question. And what happened in California is fairly typical. What happens is that a very small segment of the public health community is negotiating with the industry on something like this. And it's not that there has to be, someone has thrown out the term consensus. I don't think that's the right term. I don't think that there needs to be consensus within a given public health issue of concern over preemption before preemption is acceptable. But I believe that 80 or 90% of the key players, especially those who are the leadership at the grassroots level, or in the case of federal preemption, the state leaders need to be fully aware of, informed about, and explicitly agree to preemption before it's accepted. And then the related issue is the issue of secrecy and negotiation, which again, our research has found that regardless of the arguments that are made about the necessity of the secrecy, that's a negative for the public health community as opposed to perhaps an industry that has an interest in preemption. And related to that is the last minute preemption. We have quite a bit of stuff on that we're working on, and quite a bit of that's available already on our website. And what typically happens with preemption is that even if a public health law supported by the public health community is introduced with a savings clause, an anti-preemption clause, it's not unusual for, as in the case of California, for the savings clause to be replaced by a preemption clause, like on a Friday night before the legislation is signed on Sunday or Monday. So these are kind of the kind of details that I think everybody on this panel are in a position of expertise to answer these, and I'd love to follow up with you or anybody else on these nuances. Does that answer the question?
I just wanted to respond to that a little bit too, specifically on menu labeling. I mean, something like that is very disappointing from our perspective because so much of what is happening in a social norm change movement is working on from the best evidence possible. We may not know exactly what type of menu labeling is the most effective, and there are studies being done as we put it in place. So the opportunity to actually be able to change policies and institute new policies at the local level is so important. And so when something gets pulled out at the last minute by a small group of negotiators, that's very, very disappointing.
And the science changes. Yes. So even if we determine something today, the science could change tomorrow and we realize that there's even a better thing based on science.
Yes. I have two questions. One is for you, Jennifer. It's about seeing the use of characters more and more with more reputable companies and maybe smaller companies that kind of want to mimic the larger companies' branding or marketing. Can you maybe like address if anything's been done with that, or if they feel like it's making a difference, or if they're perpetuating this marketing behemoth? My other question is for Mark, and it's from not really knowing anything technical at all about preemption aside from the concept, but is it ever viewed by grassroots organizations where it's in a way like a culmination of their work, where they've worked so hard and they've kind of gained this capacity, but they're just not seeing it happen any other way, so it becomes favorable?
The companies have specifically excluded all their own spokes characters from all their pledges, so that's a problem. And the other thing is, we only have 17 companies in total signing on to these pledges, so it's actually getting, you're right, it's getting worse. There have been a few media associations that have stopped using their characters. I might be wrong, but I think Nickelodeon now has nutritional requirements to use their characters, but I don't remember. So some of the media companies have actually gotten on board with using, licensing out their characters less. But the pledges don't cover a lot of these things, a lot of the use of these characters. And so what's being done is I'm writing a paper about it. I mean, I'm not kidding. Nobody's, it's really not being addressed sufficiently. So we're starting to look at it. This is like a new area.
So is the question, when is federal or state preemption acceptable to the public health community? There are two questions within that. One is, when is preemption, and we address this in the checklist and the work and the literature that we're working on now, but when is preemption appropriate from a public health point of view? There are situations, they are relatively rare. An example is the airline smoking ban, which I happen to work on, where because of the nature of the regulation of commercial aircraft health and safety, it is appropriate, arguably necessary, to have federal preemption in that situation. Those situations are diminishingly rare if you look at them, because so much of public health, for example, sanitation, local sanitation rules regarding restaurants, local smoking bans, for example, so much of public health is it's better for public health to have the power to pass stronger laws, and also enforcement and compliance is often really a local issue. So there's an array of issues, but there are situations, perhaps FDA testing of prescription drugs or so on and so forth. The other question is, when would you acquiesce to preemption when it's against the, potentially against the interest of public health? And that we focus a lot on the process and the critical issue of involving all key players in an issue. Now, preemption comes up in specific issues, such as nutrition policy or toxics or CAFOs. So let's say that groups that are interested in the local regulation of concentrated animal feeding operations, the question, as long as all of the key players in that issue, from the national level to the state level to the local level and the grassroots, if they're engaged, fully informed about the negotiations and engaged in the decision making, you'll probably have the right outcome. Does that answer the question?
I think we have time for one more quick question. Yes, way in the back.
On the Look Ahead 2011 question, because you guys did such a great presentation last year, so we're looking into this year, Jennifer and Q. So I have a question for each of you. First, Q, how is the research that you did on the states with the most favorable terrain going to be used in the coming year, if at all? What's the application of that? Jennifer, what else are you publishing on? And in matter of preemption, are we hearing this today because the food and beverage industry is proposing preemption? And if so, in what domain or what sorts of legislation?
I'll go. So, you know, the one thing I didn't want to convey in my presentation, and I hope I didn't convey this, was that if you are in Virginia or Vermont, just throw your hands up and say, it's not my problem. It's just that what this research shows is that you can be more strategic about what policies you pursue. So maybe you go through some of the school opportunities that Carla talked about, some of the school meals contracts if you're in a state that doesn't have a strong home rule. I think the takeaway for the coming year would be that it would be important to know how strong your home rule state is if you are going to pursue something like the toy giveaway ordinance that's going on in Santa Clara and San Francisco, because that is, whether or not you personally agree with the policy, it's a very controversial one. It gets a lot of people talking about it, people on both sides. On the one side, people saying, you're taking toys away from kids, and then on the other side, the education that I didn't know that baseball cards used to be given out with tobacco products. That was one of the precursors of Happy Meals in some way. So that's kind of where we're headed with this research, is to try to work with advocates on understanding what their local home rule situation is.
And then I guess also, if it's so bad, you could try it at the state.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Great, yeah, exactly.
So I just got accepted a short commentary in American Journal of Preventive Medicine on front of package. I limited this commentary to health and nutrition claims and the front of package symbol, and it's actually a call for research and for more regulation. So it's actually a call for both lawyers and public health researchers. So that should be coming out, I think, March. And then I have two things that have nothing to do with what I talked about today. What attorneys general can do for obesity, coming out of American Journal of Public Health, and also what local state and local health departments can do for obesity, and those are both coming out of American Journal of Public Health in 2011. Right now, I'm writing what I hope to be a published law review article on the point of purchase promotions and the characters, and. The first sort of analysis of characters is different because it's never been litigated before. The FTC, had that Joe Campbell case, but it actually never went. It never went to litigation. They dropped it at the last minute. So we there's not a lot of literature. There's some science, but not so much First Amendment jurisprudence. So that's what I'm working on now.
To answer your question, I think that the industry's greatest fear is that the public health, the nutrition policy field will be able to nurture a successful and powerful grassroots movement for progressive and effective nutrition policy. And I believe their number one priority to prevent building any kind of effective movement in obesity prevention is federal and state preemption. And I think that's my answer to that. I hope that answers the question.
That's up for no to end. And every litigation the industry brings, they always argue preemption and First Amendment. So these are the two topics they're always hounding on.
I want to give Carla a response to an opportunity.
Right. So what we're looking at in the future in terms of food service management company contract is, of course, ensuring oversight by schools, and also looking at what are some innovative ways that we could bring in fresh fruits and vegetables to the school meals while at low cost. So looking at farm to school, looking at a school garden, and whether or not there are any legal prohibitions against schools using food grown in the school gardens in their school meals program.
Okay, well, I just want to say that there's tremendous opportunity here, and I always tell people there's no shortage of policy options out there to get involved with, and so I want to thank the speakers for a great panel, and I'm sure they'll be willing to stay and answer any questions you still might have. So thank all of you.